On the agenda today, we have discussing this pre-processing step for the API, supporting array position to property binding, asynchronous methods for the API, removing the initial context from the API spec, and use of native types when we go to and from RDF. Are there any changes to the agenda? Anything that we should discuss in addition?
I guess the only other thing is perhaps looking at the new GitHub event notification system to see if we can get all of the activity mirrored over to RDF comments.
Okay. Let's take that up as the first action item. Francois, are you in a position to scribe today?
Sure.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right, so first topic is a new GitHub event notification system. So Stefan sent an email out kind of saying maybe we could use this new mechanism on GitHub. I looked at it yesterday, and it seems like we could register another user. The downside is that when you, I think you can add an email address, but I think it's only one email address per project, maybe. So what we'd have to do is we'd have to create like an RDF comments user. And then there are two ways we could do it. Either directly through the W3C register an RDF comments user, or register something like an RDF comments reflector. It would be like RDF comments dash reflector at digitalbazaar.com. And then in our mail server, we could have it forward the mail on to RDF comments. I think either way would work fine. I don't know if people have any opinion on which way we should do it. I guess the other thing that I think we need to be concerned about is spamming the RDF comments mailing list.
I suggest we bring it up on the call tomorrow, and I think the way to do it is to create an RDF comments user, because that way other things might want to use that aside from JSON LD.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Any other opinions on how we should set it up? I don't think you have to verify the email address when you set it up. I think that's a separate process. So, I guess the other concern I have is about spamming the list with every little tiny change. There are like three options, three types of things that you can get email for. And I don't think it allows you to filter it. Like, I think whenever new issues are created and discussion on issues happens, I think all that email is sent, but also whenever you make any kind of commits to the repo, those are sent as well. And we might end up making commits to the repo that have nothing to do with the two specs that the RDF working group is working on, like normalization or just some changes to the website.
There's an argument that we maybe should be splitting stuff up, that having the website and all the various specs in one GitHub project perhaps is too global, and instead using sub-projects might be a better way to manage that. There was also a suggestion that we look at using, say, GH pages for the normal website.
Hmm. Are we allowed to run code on the GH pages stuff?
You can run some code. You can run JavaScript.
JavaScript on the server, or go ahead.
There is a templating system which I'm not familiar with. I think Nicholas, you've done some stuff with, haven't you?
With
GitHub pages?
Yeah, well, I've only used them statically, so I haven't really utilized that part.
The only reason I ask is because we have this mechanism that we're building into the JSON-LD playground that allows you to look up contexts, even if cores is disabled. So we either need to run that on a separate site or just continue to run it the way we're running it.
Well, I think they're really two separable issues. Because certainly we can keep the PHP system the way we have it today.
Right. I guess the other issue is that all the minutes are generated using the PHP, and indexes are built, and it goes in and figures out what decisions were made. So it needs write access. That's done dynamically. I don't know. It just to me, at least, it seems like a bit too much of a headache right now. Basically, given the choice between spamming RDF comments and re-architecting the site, I'd rather spam RDF comments. So I don't know if anyone has any stronger opinions on.
Yeah, alternatively, that's another reason to use a reflector, which would allow some filtering to be put into place.
Right. Okay. Well, I guess then what we'll do is we'll propose a reflector to the RDF comments group tomorrow and see what they say. Or sorry, the RDF working group tomorrow and see what they say. All right. Anything else on this topic before we move on? I am getting some background noise from somebody. I don't know who it is, but it's like constant talking.
Yeah, I hear something too.
There, now it's gone.
Yeah.
All right. Next topic, issue 149. And the link to the issue is here. So this issue is an attempt to address some of the other concerns that people have. The pre-processing step is a way of basically modifying the incoming JSON-LD document, modifying the incoming JSON so that it becomes a JSON-LD document. So the first thing where this might apply is that, we have this requirement to do to basically split out things that are an array into properties, so where each position in the array maps to a different RDF property. So, for example, having latitude and longitude in a geo position. So there are two ways that I think we've proposed of resolving this problem. The first is to put in a declarative mechanism in JSON-LD that allows you to say this array item maps to this RDF term. The other approach is a more generalized preprocessing step that would basically take the incoming JSON and modify it such that the array positions, they would know the term that it would be passed off to the function, the JSON document, every key value would be passed off to a function, and then you would modify the keys and the values based on what you're given. So that would allow us to support this positional, this positional conversion to and from JSON-LD without having to put in the declarative mechanism. It might also allow us to do other things that are useful as well. The downside to this, or the I think the biggest argument against this, is that people could already do this by just running some JavaScript over the JSON that they get in. It won't be JSON-LD, but they can always run some JavaScript function, over the JSON and convert it to a JSON-LD document and then put it through the processor. So what are the general thoughts on this pre-processing step? Is it something that seems like it would be useful? Is it something that we don't want to do and instead we want to look at the declarative thing? Or is this something that we don't want to support and we really don't even want to support a declarative mechanism either? Nicholas, you're on the queue.
I'm for declarative or nothing. I don't think that adding this would be any practical advantage, really. And I also agree that... now I hear a lot of noise. Do you guys also do that?
Yeah,
a lot of background.
A
yeah. Anyway, as you say, you could already do that, and this doesn't define anything. So I see no practical advantage to it, and I also fear that to some extent it says that any arbitrary JSON may be JSON-LD as long as there is some pre-processing hook handling it, and thus that only leaves the spec with a point of indecision, I think. So I'd prefer declarative. I mean, the only way to understand the JSON, if you just read it, is if there is some declarative token to represent what these variants mean, like positional attributes. So declarative or nothing for me.
Greg, you're on the queue.
Yeah, I'm of the same opinion. One is we, of course, received very strong feedback from Sandro on the RDF call last week against this notion. And I also think it's just not necessary to say that you can, that there's a pre-processing step. It just doesn't really do anything within the language itself. Be extremely difficult to test something like this because it basically just says, you know, run whatever code you want, and we're just going to provide you a callback way to be able to feed you keys and values. There's many other ways to do that through a JSON structure, so not really necessary to do within the language. And I think as such doesn't really provide any usefulness for authors since they really have no way of knowing whether how to implement this within some context. So on the playground, for instance, I would need to program presumably something in JavaScript which would be called back so that you could process my variation on JSON-LD, and that just wouldn't happen. So I agree that if we want to support something like this, it should be a declarative mechanism.
Okay. Any other opinions on this, Francois or Marcus or Dave Lane?
No, I completely agree with what Nicholas and Craig said.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. I think those are all very good points. To play devil's advocate for half a second, one reason we might want to put this in here is that we might want to spell it out very explicitly that there is, you know, people can do a pre-processing step. Sometimes when it comes to these specs and the APIs, if it's not in the core documentation, sometimes it doesn't register with developers that it's a possibility, right? So putting this in the spec and having something that says, you know, pre-process and then pass it a function for pre-processing might trigger people to think differently about the data that they're feeding JSON-LD in that they might, you know, they might think, oh, well, all I have to do is implement this really tiny pre-processing step, and all of a sudden I can convert my JSON data right now into JSON-LD. Is that argument convincing or not?
Go ahead, Nicholas.
I was just going to I think that there might be general JSON transform specs floating around, which might be more applicable in that case. But Greg,
well, there's, for instance, JSON LD macros, which is intended to do something like this, and perhaps someplace in informative text. A description of one of the advantages of JSON is that there is already a rich tool set for working with it, and in some instances authors might find that combining other tools with JSON LD processing might be another way to achieve their goals.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So I guess the proposal then is to not support a preprocessing step in the JSON LD API. Does that seem like a good proposal? Francois, you're on the queue.
Can you hear me? Am I muted?
Yes.
Sorry, you can hear me. Good. Well, I haven't given much thought, I must say. One thing that developers very often use is, for instance, if you take the replace function of JavaScript, you have a way to give it a function that will actually change the string and process it the way you want. You have another way to do it. You can just use a regular string that gives that gives the replacement string, but you can use you can also give a function that would just do whatever you want, and that's more flexible. So I sympathized with the with Manu on this on the flexibility from a developer's perspective. Now I would say an external point of view, the declarative mechanism just seems rather complex for not much added value, but I may be wrong. Anyway, so I'm not feeling strongly one way or the other, but I'm just I would be fine with a function, I would say.
Okay. Greg, you're on the queue.
Yeah, I think this is a really good use for a wiki section on the website, which I think perhaps would be a way to sort of kickstart some forum for people expressing their techniques for working with JSON LD.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe
right.
Not a wiki exactly, but perhaps some area within the website which is intended for just pages to be added.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. We've been wanting to do this for the RDFA stuff as well. It's like a best practices / tricks of the trade kind of page, and always the difficult part is finding the time to sit down and write that stuff. But yeah, I totally agree with you, Greg. We should have something on there. I don't know if we'd want to go as far as putting it into the spec to say, hey, you know, if you wanted to modify your data, here's a replace function that shows you how to do it. And we could use the geo example as an example of, you know, of doing it. It would be a fairly compact example.
Well, we do have to be careful. The replace function is a JavaScript function, and JavaScript is only one of the host languages for JSON LD, although
sure.
Naturally a fairly native, common one to use.
Mm-hmm. Nicholas, you're on the queue.
I think that we should be careful about this notion in the spec, because the purpose of JSON LD is to define the precise semantics of a JSON LD document, and these all relate to arbitrary consumption of it. I mean, of course, to some extent it's based on JSON LD, but once you provide some undefined hook or notions of transforming stuff, we leave the design and the decisions in the wake, and we're back at square one to some extent. I mean, you could always say JSON plus code equals RDF. I mean, that's just how people do it today, and the purpose of JSON-LD is to define the semantics so that you can directly express your RDF. So I'd be careful in what we say.
Right. Okay. So not we don't put it in the spec. Okay, so the proposal is do not support a pre-processing step option to transform incoming JSON. Wait a second. Do not support a pre-processing step option in the JSON-LD API to transform incoming JSON. Dave Lane, plus one, minus one, plus zero. Okay, resolved. All right, next up is issue 146, support array position to property binding. So this is the reason we talked about the pre-processing step is because it would kind of prime the conversation for this next topic. Which is supporting array position to property binding, a declarative form of array position to property binding. This was raised by Rito, I think, if I remember correctly. And basically, the argument was that they have a bunch of data that are basically lat long coordinates, and they don't want to have to be overly verbose in their data. Basically, they're afraid that if they're verbose in their data, that the data size is going to, double to triple, if not more. And they've already got, they want to work with the data in its kind of native form, which is just as arrays of, basically are tuples, lat long tuples. So the request was basically, please support this container mechanism where the container is an array, and then you say what the mapping for each index is. I believe they're the only people that have asked us for this so far, and I think we have a solution for them, which is, well, just pre-process and post-process the JSON input, change it to JSON-LD. I guess, do we feel that is something that is acceptable to Rito and his team? I don't think they're going to be happy if we don't support this, but I also think that the previous point that was made about this being, we're adding complexity to the spec without really getting anything in return for it. And when we look at features that we could cut, this is one of them. We don't have to support this feature because there is a way of, basically supporting this input, the conversion to JSON-LD and back. So any thoughts on this particular issue? Should we support a declarative way of associating array position to RDF properties, or should we not support that right now and basically tell people that they need to use pre-processing and post-processing steps to do it? Greg, you're on the queue.
One of Sandra's objections to doing sort of pre-processing was that the place to do these things was in RDF rather than invent different mechanisms for different serializations, create a common serialization or common serialization standards that then use a a single mechanism for doing that type of processing. So one way you could imagine that this could be done is by using a list form, which would then get you a predictable RDF pattern out, to which you might then match, you might do standard, you know, like a Sparkle type of convention, where you would then match on variable positions within a RDF collection off of some property, and then use that in order to generate code that created these properties. That would be a way to do this entirely in the RDF space. And in this case, I'm inclined to think that that's probably the way that this happens, because then that would allow you to use a very compact form within a turtle expression as well. Mm-hmm. There's also a tendency, I think, that we've sort of been out looking for, as Jason LD, sort of looking for groups to adopt what we're doing. So a little bit of wanting to be everything to everyone, and I think we have to be very careful about that. One of the differences between this, say, and language maps is that for language maps, we have two different communities that have very similar reasons, and also a reason that it makes sense to do something like that with respect to JSON, namely using object syntax rather than array syntax. In this case, this sort of tuple notation seems extremely domain-specific, and I think there, as I outlined, I think there are other ways to do this with an RDF.
Nicholas, you're on the queue.
Yeah, I think I agree with that in general. Even in JSON, the ideas of tuples aren't as common as the notion of mapping on other things than properties, so that property values can be keys in JSON. That's more common. And also, Sparkle construct approaches and similar could solve it in general. There might be interest for a vocabulary expressing these things more tersely. Also, as you say, there has been one request, and we shouldn't include this until we know that there is a general demand. That itself raises the question of whether or not after JSON LD 1.0, we will sort of decommission the activity and wait for eventual IDs to come along and prompt us to do a 1.1, or if we should to some extent plan for some kind of activity so that we could reach a 1.1 within a couple of years at most, if there is a demand for these features, so that we could keep this on a sort of proposal list and ask people who consume and publish JSON LD to continuously debate this, and we might actually come around to it eventually. Because I've seen this idea, I had this idea when I saw especially GeoJSON, because that's a prime example of using this terse notation, and it's a fairly straightforward proposal to make, albeit it does make the spec more complex, certainly. But it would be interesting to see. I mean, one that I think of Sparkle, because that's a fairly good example of a success in coming to a 1.1 with all the added features that they've discussed previously, but didn't want to prematurely finalize in 1.0, and that's been clearly successful, because Sparkle 1.0 was deployed and lots of the IDs that were floating around were subsequently finalized in the 1.1 fairly soon afterwards. Mm-hmm. So that the implementations were still, there were still lots of activity in the implementing teams, so that 1.1 wasn't like XSLT 1.1 or 2.0 mm-hmm. really didn't take off.
Okay. So, yeah, at one point someone mentioned that, well, they could maybe use, you know, Sparkle to solve this issue. And I agree with everything that's been said. I said so far, I think that we probably don't want to end up supporting this feature. But I think the argument that we don't want to support this feature because they can always do the transformation in RDF or Sparkle, is that solution, I don't think it would be acceptable to the large group of developers that are using JSON-LD, right? So I think one of the goals with JSON-LD is that you don't have to drop back to RDF and you don't have to drop back to Sparkle to solve your problems. You can just work with the data directly in JSON. And I just don't think that telling people that, oh, well, you can write a, you know, a Sparkle statement, or you can mess with some turtle, or you can, you know, mess with the RDF to create RDF that you can work with. While I agree that it's true, I think it would just completely go over the heads of people that you know care mostly about linked data in JSON and don't really care all that much about RDF or Sparkle. So that said, it sounds like the proposal is to not support a declarative mechanism that allows you to map array position to RDF properties. Is there anyone that disagrees with that? Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, well, regarding sort of Sparkle as being a very much of an RDFism, we also had some discussion on a query mechanism that I put out there sort of based upon BGP. And if we did have something like that, then what that starts to look like is a sort of a very Sparkle-like mechanism within JSON, in which case something like that might be used for a construct thing. If that was the case, then that might be the basis of actually doing a Sparkle processor, but something that's more idiomatically JSON. And I think if we had something like that, then it would be open to quite a large number of sort of patterns that it could be solutions for. That's something I think is probably a different spec, but could be really useful. And then also for anyone that really doesn't want to work in that space, being JSON, they're free to work on it using their own private tool sets. It just mm-hmm. doesn't become open as a standard mechanism for everyone to use. But again, mm-hmm. it's trying to be too much, you know, of a general solution for every kind of problem. I think it starts to become a problem for us.
Right. All right. So, yes, definitely agreed. Here's the proposal. Do not support a declarative mechanism that is capable of mapping array position to an RDF property. Then Nicholas, there we go. Okay, all right, so that is resolved. Next up is asynchronous methods for the API. So topic issue 147, asynchronous methods for the API. The link for that is here.
It's adding synchronous methods.
I'm sorry. You're absolutely right. Let me change that. Add synchronous methods, yes. Issue 147. Add synchronous methods to the API. So this is Nicholas raised this. Go ahead, Nicholas. If you could give us some background on this issue.
Yeah. Well, initially, it became not an issue, but it struck me as a bit odd when I tried to used the API in my RDFA lab experiments where I had previously didn't use the JSON-LD API, just raw JSON-LD and mapped in a kind of API experiment for the RDF API. And I think that from what I understand, the reason for the expand and compact methods being asynchronous is that there can be external contexts which have to be fetched. And in JavaScript, that the dominating pattern is to use callbacks for anything that uses I/O, both because the XML HTTP request API by default is asynchronous, and previously only was in certain implementations was only asynchronous, and also that Node.js is predominantly asynchronous when it comes to I/O. Other languages aren't necessarily, and even in both in XML HTTP request in browsers and in Node.js, you can do synchronous calls for I/O as well. So it might be interesting, based only on that, to add synchronous companion methods or alternate behavior for them if they lack a callback, so that they become synchronous even when doing I/O. If that's too much, one might say that it would be nice for companion methods to be added which can compact and expand for the cases when all the input is already loaded, when you have no external context to fetch, which is basically the case when you have expanded JSON-LD and a custom context which you possibly have defined already in code. In many cases, that was the only cases I had, so it struck me as a bit of jumping through the callback hoops to have callbacks in my code examples. I'm not sure what the behavior would be then if you had a system which had to be asynchronous and you tried to do the synchronous version of the call and you needed to look up something through an I/O request. But in general, I think it would be a nice.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No. I'm done with this summary.
Okay. So there was an interesting talk that Dave Longley forwarded on JavaScript and Node.js that Crockford gave, and so he pointed out that, you know, Node.js has basically almost everything in Node.js is done asynchronously. There are these sync calls. Every file system, I believe file system call has its associated sync call if you want to make the call synchronously. And it's certainly it's nice for folks that have a background in kind of synchronous programming, so Python and Ruby and Perl and things like that. One of the interesting things he said during the talk, though, was that it was a mistake to add any kind of sync call because that adds complexity in that. Now all of a sudden you don't know if your call is going to be operating synchronously or asynchronously. So if you only provide an asynchronous API, then you know that that the system is going to make the best effort to do everything asynchronously. However, if you have a sync call, you don't know when you call an asynchronous method, if it's going to block somewhere deep down because someone decided to use the sync call to do something. So I think the counter argument here to not have sync calls is that we give people enough rope to hang themselves, meaning that if we only provide the async call, if there's a language like Python or Perl and people implement it and they do make synchronous calls in the function callback, that's fine. That's up to them, right? The API for the API is trying to be asynchronous for languages that can be asynchronous. But if we provide this, sync and async call, there are basically two. It doubles the size of the API. It's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, we have like what, 6 calls instead of 3 or whatever we have now. But it might be confusing. It's not confusing. It might cause issues for developers that don't know what's happening deep down. So if we are going to provide both synchronous and asynchronous methods, what we might do is say that you only have to implement one set of it. So you only have to implement the synchronous methods, or you only have to implement the asynchronous methods. You don't have to implement both. Another approach that we could take is to say that the methods don't need to be implemented, or rather they have signatures for both synchronous and asynchronous, and we don't change the method names. It's just that the API developers decide which one of the APIs they're going to implement, the synchronous one or the asynchronous one. And that's somewhat problematic because the arguments you pass to the asynchronous methods and the synchronous methods are slightly different. So more than likely, we're just going to end up with two different method signatures for the synchronous methods and the asynchronous methods. I think my preference would be to just provide asynchronous methods right now, because I believe that even in Python and Ruby, it's not such a big deviation to pass a function pointer or basically, a lambda or a function pointer into an API. I think my preference would just to be just asynchronous for now until more people start yelling at us that we need to provide a synchronous mechanism as well. Any other thoughts on this?
Would it be an option to just add a note to the spec saying that implementers are free to drop the callback parameter and implement the API synchronously instead? So basically leave it up to the implementer of a library or a processor.
Yeah, I mean, we could do that, but then we have two different APIs. We have a synchronous versus an asynchronous API. I don't know if I think yes, that's certainly an option. I don't know if we should take that option. I think we should try and just make it really simple and say, look, this is an asynchronous interface. Just use that.
What I'm trying to say is we don't specify two sets of APIs. We just add a note to the spec that implementers are free to implement a synchronous instead if they prefer that and are
right.
Still compliant to the spec.
Right. I understand. I'm saying we should not do that because we effectively end up with two different method signatures and people can't tell based on I guess they could tell. See, the whole, I think one of the things that we try to achieve when we create these APIs is that we want a drop-in replacement, the ability for people to do a drop-in replacement, like just take one implementation in Python and drop in a completely different implementation in Python and not have to change your code at all. You just change your import statement, basically, and that's it. But if we allow people, if we allow implementers to not allow the callback mechanism, then we lose that drop-in replacement functionality. These APIs are no longer drop-in replaceable. Greg, you're on the queue.
Yeah, so my implementation is actually synchronous. I don't basically thread off the I/O and do that. However, I implement, of course, the asynchronous signature. So all the data is provided by a callback, but it's also provided as a result of the function call. I didn't feel I needed any particular license in order to do that, since I correspond to the method signature. And as you noted, in some languages are much more suited for synchronous style programming, in which case you can make use of that. I might provide some documentation to the effect that the calls can be used either way, either via callback or as a return result, which is in fact the convention for Ruby. If you pass a block to a method, then you do not necessarily expect a callback, a return from the call, but rather that it can be run within that context. So I don't think we need to do anything in order to enable people to implement these existing API mechanisms synchronously. And I also agree that we should not provide new method signatures to do something which can be done using sort of standard mechanisms in different languages already. So easy enough to do a wrapper in your JavaScript library to provide synchronous adapters for this without having to make it part of the spec.
Let's see. Francois, you're on the queue next. You might be muted.
With JavaScript APIs.
Hold on, sorry, you were muted. We didn't hear when you started out.
Okay, let me. So while you were speaking, I was looking at another document being prepared by some other working groups dealing with JavaScript APIs in W3C, looking at the API design cookbook in particular. And actually, the funny thing is that the asynchronous section is actually empty for the time being, but it might be wise to get in touch with Robin, the editor, at least, or maybe just the community group. I think it's a community group, but it's a joint work between different working groups, the device APIs working group, I don't remember actually, but it's written in the document. It's the device API working group in particular. And my preference would be for asynchronous methods only, as Greg and Manu. But they may have other feedback that might be useful for us.
What was the last part? You'd prefer asynchronous only, but...
They may have useful feedback for us on when to use, when to be asynchronous or when not to be asynchronous.
All right. Do we, I think, let's see, does anyone have any arguments, any other arguments to for or against the adding asynchronous or adding synchronous API calls to the API spec?
I'd say that in Python, it's not common at all to pass callbacks. It's more common if you have the advanced needs of something asynchronous to use continuations behind the scenes or other libraries, which makes the asynchronous programming model hidden behind a simpler API. Because I am probably biased by the years doing Python, so I feel that callbacks, unless absolutely necessary and understandably necessary, often makes the code more complex to read. I've even seen examples where asynchronous became so popular that people started replacing return statements with callbacks all over the place, and that's going too far. So I'm a bit wary about it when it's not really needed. Of course, here's the case where you may have external contexts, so you have to load them, so I understand that. But I'd still be in favor of probably the second alternative. If you pass no callback, you would return the data when the processing is complete.
Okay, so that's an interesting option, because that means that we could keep the signatures the same between synchronous and asynchronous implementations. We could keep the method signatures the same across all implementations. It's just that if you don't provide a callback, your data is returned to you immediately.
Yeah, that's basically the way things typically work in Ruby. The callback mechanism in Ruby, it's more natural to use a block. So my implementation mm-hmm. uses both a block or basically a method parameter and treats them equivalently. And in the absence of that, then yes, it's a synchronous data return. So I think that's a reasonable approach, is to provide some behavior in the case that there is no callback provided. But then we're placing a burden on implementers, and there again is perhaps a testability issue. And in general, I don't know how we do API testing, but
you mean how we verify whether it's an asynchronous or a synchronous call?
Well, I guess in general, if you have something that's programmatic, how we can provide a generalized mechanism to test all of the various implementations in different languages. APIs.
Right. Yeah. There usually isn't one. You need a different test suite for each language.
That's sort of a different issue. Right?
Sure.
I do agree that perhaps as a should behavior, not necessarily a must, that in the absence of a callback, the API call should return data synchronously. That does complicate the idle a little bit, though.
I'd be fine with the should, I think. Also, a side question. It's in JavaScript, it might be a bit tricky to convert the asynchronous to asynchronous in the end, unless you do, which I did for my own experiment, just a while loop, which waited for the values to be set, which feels really nasty.
That's a good argument to not even not have it be should behavior, just a may behavior.
Yeah. And given that both.
Queue. Sorry, Nicholas. Francois's been on the queue for a bit.
I think against a different behavior based on the absence of the presence of a parameter and a function. It's already hard to find your way in asynchronous calls in JavaScript. So if you if the behavior changes when you miss a parameter because you're making a mistake, and that happens from time to time, especially because writing asynchronous code is indeed difficult. Not my fault, but that's how it goes. I think we're just, that will just trigger headaches. So I would really not go down this path. The sync method, adding a sync companion would be probably the way to go if we decide to go down that road. But I wouldn't use the same function for both. Or an explicit parameter as in jQuery, as noted before.
Nicholas, you're on the queue.
Yeah, I don't think it's that uncommon, though. Although recently I've seen it, I haven't done much JavaScript for some time, but I've seen that behavior in the RDF store JS package, for instance. Also, in this specific case, if you don't have a callback, the behavior from that mistake would be fairly the same regardless, because either you would, well, you would fail them.
So I really can't think of an example in JavaScript doing that, but I'll dig it up just to, maybe it's common, I just never encountered it.
We've been doing quite a bit of Node.js development over the past couple of months, and I have never seen an API, any of the core Node.js APIs that do that. And I tend to think that the Node.js APIs are fairly well engineered. I do agree with Francois. I think it would be very dangerous to change the behavior just because you forgot to add a parameter. In one case, it's a neat trick, right? It's a good trick, and it would keep the API the same. But I think that Francois has a very strong argument, which is you don't want to switch the behavior of a function between synchronous and asynchronous just because they didn't provide a callback function. I can see arguments both ways, but what I haven't seen is a standard pattern in Node.js for switching how a function behaves based on whether or not you include a parameter or not. So we may want to say that API developers may provide synchronous mechanisms, and instead of passing a callback in each one of the methods, you end up returning the data directly. That might be the best approach to this, and we may not want to spec out the synchronous methods. Nicholas, do you think that would be acceptable? Because that would allow Python developers to just implement the synchronous methods and leave it at that, or implement the asynchronous and the synchronous methods, whereas the synchronous methods would have sync on the end. We would just not go to the trouble of speccing the entire web IDL for the synchronous methods.
Yeah, sure, something to that effect. What was the specific proposal for that? To add
documentation to the JSON-LD API that
right.
States that the core implementation, the core web IDL is going to only be asynchronous, but if a developer would like to implement an asynchronous interface, that they can add sync to the end of each one of the calls, remove the callback parameter, and return the data from the call. And that would apply to every single method call. And that's a may.
Yeah. That sounds fair enough.
Any other thoughts from the group on this?
Is that dropping the callback at the end and adding what? Here it is.
Yeah.
What's that? The flag?
No flag. They just add sync. So they drop the callback, add the word SYNC to the end of the. Yep, exactly. And then the return is the result of the call.
Is there any
the only
flag,
issue?
I think.
Yeah, I didn't. Hear either one of you. Marcus.
Is there a need to add that sync? Why can't they have the same name and just drop the callback?
Because in languages where parameters can be optional, the signature is not going to really. We have the same problem that we had before, right? The signature it doesn't matter what the signature is. If they forget the callback, all of a sudden the method functions completely differently than it would if it was asynchronous. So if for example a JavaScript implementer implements both a synchronous and asynchronous method, and the people forget to add the callback, is that true? I'm wondering if so if they don't add the sync, if they don't add the sync to the method name, then people could call the method and forget to put the call back, and then the functionality, how the method operates switches from being asynchronous to synchronous, but the signature looks exactly the same to the developer.
The
first problem is that pattern is not used. At least from our experience, the pattern is not used very widely in JavaScript. It would be strange. It would be deviating from what people are used to as far as APIs. So in Node.js and most JavaScript, if you have a method that functions synchronously, you want to warn the developer that it is functioning synchronously, because in general you don't want your JavaScript code to block unless you're absolutely sure you want to block at that particular call. So this would inject a blocking call into code without the developer knowing that they have inserted a blocking call into the code.
Yeah, the only thing is it's a bit weird if you just implement a synchronous version and you have a sync at the end of every method. That just looks completely weird.
That's a bit of the issue I've had with it in general, because given that the web ideally is language agnostic to, well, a certain extent at least, and if you want to implement this in Java or C#, you have ordinarily no callbacks for these operations there. Of course, things change and Java will be getting lambdas and so on, but there has been no precedent for this pattern previously.
Francois, you're on the queue.
Yeah, so I was looking at the JSON-LD API document, the compact and the extend methods. I'm wondering about the error mechanism. Here I see that an appropriate exception must be thrown when something wrong occurs, but in JavaScript you cannot, unless I'm wrong, you cannot just throw an exception when you're already in a real asynchronous I/O operation. That means if you're loading a remote context, sending an HTTP request to some other domain or to the cloud, if something wrong happens, you're already you cannot just throw an exception and catch it from the main part of the program. I don't know if I'm clear, but I can write it down.
Yeah, well, it's not the error mechanism that we have is not throwing an exception. It is just calling a callback, and that callback, I believe the way it's currently written or the way it's currently designed, has the option of telling the processor to stop or continue.
Okay, so I may not be reading the right document then.
It might not be updated in the document you are reading. Even the very latest version might not have that in there.
Okay, so...
Yeah, the spec wasn't updated, but I just pasted a link to the resolution in IRC.
Okay, good. So I'm all set.
All right.
Thanks.
So going back to, I guess, Nicholas's and Marcus's concern of adding sync to the end of the method signature, Yeah, I guess the problem that we're having here is that the way a lot of these languages are designed conflict with one another, right? So JavaScript and Node.js, the design is asynchronous all the time unless there's a very good reason to be synchronous, and there almost never is a good reason to be synchronous. The approach with Java and Python is synchronous all the time unless you want to go asynchronous, and at that point you have to deal with, you know, all the other issues with doing that. So I guess I don't know. I mean, I think they're good arguments either way. I think I still think we should just provide asynchronous only. One of the other reasons could be that you know, Francois just pointed out that we have this error mechanism that requires a callback. So the error mechanism is problematic as well. The error mechanism is problematic as well if you can't pass in callbacks to the options that you pass into these methods, because I'm trying to think of the best way you'd implement this in Python. I guess you would make the call and you would have to pass in a callback to say whether or not to continue processing, right? You couldn't just return an exception whenever you hit something that you couldn't continue processing. So we already have this requirement in the API to pass in a callback for the error mechanism. So I'm wondering why we would, if we have that requirement, then they're going to have to pass in a callback anyway, and if that's the case, then why aren't we just providing an asynchronous mechanism?
Isn't that a different scenario, an advanced scenario? In general, I think that asynchronous APIs are much more complex. It's only because you really need to do non-blocking I/O in certain environments that these are present in any case.
I believe that wholeheartedly about 3 months ago, before we started really, really sinking our teeth into Node.js, and now I'm of the opposite opinion, that yes, they look complicated if you implement them a certain way, but Node.js has a really nice way of implementing asynchronous interfaces. There's a module called async, and it allows you to do a whole bunch of really neat stuff using the asynchronous mechanism. It is really difficult to think about the problem in that way, or to basically think about problems in that way when you first get started with Node.js. Like, I hated it in the beginning, but now I've gotten used to it such that when I jump back to doing Python programming, I wish that it had asynchronous interfaces instead of synchronous ones. I think there are just fundamental differences in these programming languages, and that's affecting, you know, what we think is the most natural API here.
Yeah, well, I mean, the point is also that in Python it would just be synchronous. The only difference is that you call a callback. It wouldn't become asynchronous just because you have a callback.
That's true, yeah. But you could make it asynchronous, but yeah, you're absolutely right. It would still be a synchronous call with a callback. But it's doable.
It can be done with continuations. Even in Node.js, there has been complaints about the asynchronous model because it is a direct added complexity to the APIs, which people feel should have been done with fibers or continuations in the back end. And there are experiments to that effect as well. So I think that The arguments go back and forth in all of these communities all of the time. In Python, we have had Twisted as the net API, and now there are much more interesting continuation using things, using yield in the back end, which is what Guido proposes for the certain APIs that they do with the various web products they had. So
So I guess
it's
what
not a clear case.
I'm wondering. So maybe the way to resolve this is go back to Francois's comment that basically says that, well, the developer might forget to include the callback, and if they forget to include the callback, then that's an issue. If they forget to include the callback, then it's going to act completely differently. And at that point, we might just say tough. If the developer forgets to include the callback, they're using the API incorrectly, or they thought they were using it asynchronously, and now they're using it synchronously. And that's that. That's how you switch between synchronous and asynchronous. You either provide a callback if you want it to be asynchronous, or you don't if you want it to be synchronous. And then the method signature is the same across all the languages. And then it's up to the implementer to figure out whether or not they support the callback parameter. Or rather, I guess what we're saying is that they have to implement, all implementations have to implement the callback parameter, just people in the Python world will probably not use the callback parameter when they're programming with this system. So that means that the proposal becomes the API signatures across all languages is the exact same. If you want the method call to operate synchronously, don't include the callback parameter. How do people feel about that proposal now that we've had this long discussion about it?
Well, that's basically what, like I said, that's what I do in my Ruby implementation. So.
Mm-hmm.
And that corresponds to standard Ruby behavior method signatures.
Okay.
In general, I like it better, but I very much respect the notion of mistakes. And I think I support this approach, although I'd like to make some side of. Maybe we should defer the decision or vote, but say that we should verify how this is done in various JavaScript APIs. If there is,
yeah.
I mean, I've seen certain cases where this has been used, and maybe we should look into if these are very uncommon or if people have had hard problems using these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to put a proposal and then do our plus one, minus one, plus zeros on it, and then note at the end that we believe this is the right direction to go, but we want to research it more before we're absolutely sure about making this the way the signatures for the methods.
I think the way to do that is to just in the spec put a note saying we're looking for feedback on this issue, or that the element that mechanism is at risk.
Yeah,
and that provides a specific way for people to provide feedback. And we can also, by the way, I believe the change I made for the issue URLs. Has been in there, so if we update to the latest respec, we should be able to actually directly link back to the discussion on GitHub.
Okay, good. Okay. Let's see. Okay, so the proposal is the JSON-LD API signature across JSON-LD API method signatures across all languages are exactly the same. If a developer wants synchronous behavior, they must not add the callback parameter. Let's see. Okay, the JSON-LD API method signatures across languages. Add a note to the JSON-LD API spec stating that this functionality is.
I would just change note to issue marker.
Risk. Let's see. Add a issue marker issue marker to the JSON-LD API spec stating that this functionality is at risk. Okay, how does that look for a proposal?
And that issue, is that fully, is that described adequately in issue 147? Yeah, I guess so. So we just link to 147.
Yeah. Yep.
Perhaps after copying some of this discussion as a comment within there.
Yeah, we should update that issue with the latest discussion. I mean, the resolution that we just made, and then maybe some filler to talk about why the decision was made, why we made the decision in that way. All right. Let's see, 11:17. Next topic up is removing the initial context from the API spec. So let's see, we've talked about this many times before, I feel, but we never end up resolving it, or we resolved it and we forgot to note it. Opening it up. Okay, so we had this idea that there is an initial context. Oh, wait a second. I'm sorry. I'm completely wrong about this. So there was a proposal, I think, Greg, you made the proposal that the initial context would have two items in it, where at type is a URL and at graph is a URL, or is an at ID. And then that would basically, Marcus had an issue with that because he said that type could be overwritten if it exists in the initial context, and we didn't want that to happen. So the question still is, do we have a use for the initial context? And I think at this point in the development process, we don't really. I mean, we could kind of put some of these things in the initial context, but we can always introduce an initial context at a later date. And I think the reason we wanted the initial context in there is because it would allow us to add something into the document or add something into the context that would kind of future-proof the language. It would allow us to kind of fix the language as we go forward without having to release a new spec. And that's the reason the initial context exists for RDFA. I don't know if we need the same kind of functionality this early in JSON-LD. I mean, if people mismark up, if they mark up their JSON-LD incorrectly or they don't link to the proper context, the data is just not going to come over when you expand or compact or convert to and from RDF. So I think that's the behavior is a bit different in JSON-LD. So I guess the proposal is, do not support initial context in JSON-LD 1.0. If we want to support it in the future, we can always support it. Greg, you're on the queue. Sorry.
Well, I think there's a big push for us to reach feature freeze, and if we take this out now, I think it might in fact become very difficult to put it back in. And I don't think we've really ever had a real discussion over an initial context and the type of things that we might put in there, for instance, prefix definitions, things like that. I don't know if the specific type thing makes sense because type is treated differently than other properties in any case. but I think it's valuable to have it in there, even if it is empty, just sort of for the reasons that you mentioned, because it does allow us to guard against some future proofing by providing a mechanism by which we can add things to it in the future without having to re-release the spec. My feeling that trying to say, well, and where I've seen some arguments in the RDF list that, you know, we really need to tone this down, feature freeze, and then address everything else in a 1.1 or 2.0 spec is a real problem, because that could easily be, you know, 2-3 years away, and that just does not meet the requirements, the pace with which the development community is moving. So I've voted against, or I've raised my voice against freezing right now, but similarly, I think by taking something like this out, it could make it very difficult for us to, procedurally, for us to address these issues. So even if it's empty, I propose that we continue to reference the initial context, and in fact use language similar to RDFA did that sort of describes the mechanism by which it might be updated, so that authors can take that into impact. And then at some point in the future, we should discuss whether it makes sense for us to predefine prefixes in there. XSD is one that is easy to forget, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, so then the proposal would be include...
Sorry.
Go ahead, Marcus.
Craig, why do you see a problem to bring it back in the future if we don't include it now? I mean, it's basically one... It's mentioned once in all the algorithms, and that's an expansion. When you reset the context, and that's it.
Yeah.
So
I'm just thinking procedurally within the RDF working group is once it comes out with an FPWD, I think adding something like that back could face opposition within that group that I'd rather not have to go through. I think it's much better to just keep it in there, and I don't really see it. It seems to me that just is a reasonable future-proofing step for us to reference in a default context. Of course, it's reference and expansion, but I don't think it really costs us anything to keep it in there.
The way it's specified currently, you can't even modify it without changing the spec, so I don't see any value, to be honest.
Then I think that's something we need to address. I think we should define a mechanism similar to what we do in RDFA, by which the default context can be updated outside of the spec.
Yeah, that's not really something I would like to see.
Nicholas, you're on the queue.
Yeah, I agree with Marcus' last statement, actually, because I'm a bit wary about... I don't much care for the live status of the default context in RDFA either, because that means implementations may get out of sync, and it is more confusing for authors. Given that we have a clean slate here, we can say that you have to define every prefix, and hopefully the community authoring the JSON-LD context is more aware of what they're doing than the general HTML author community, which we aimed for when we included the default context in RDFA. There we sort of had to add the Facebook Open Graph prefix and stuff like that, because they were missing in web documents, so that was kind of a social hack. But I think that it would be much simpler if we didn't have that here, and I'm worried about that growing and making things out of sync. You have to monitor that context sort of sometimes as a user, as a consumer of JSON-LD. Is there some specific things that we suspect or expect that we should add to that context apart from XSC and RDF and those?
Well, I guess the so I'm on the fence on this particular issue. I put myself on the queue to say that if we had initial context, it would be completely external to the spec. It would be outside the spec so that we could modify it, and specifically it would be Yvonne Herman would have the job of modifying it and updating it whenever we felt it necessary. The RDFA initial context was really, really helpful when we needed to convince large companies that they needed to support basically RDFA. So basically this is unfortunate, but usually communication breaks down at some point, and a large company like Facebook or Google ends up publishing a bunch of data which they think is valid JSON-LD or valid RDFA, or they tell their developers to do something, and they either mess up the initial implementation, or they tell the developers to do the right thing and they don't, which is most of the developers didn't include the OG prefixes in their markup, right? And so we didn't know that that was a problem until after the fact. You don't know it's a problem until after it happens. And if we don't have a mechanism to correct that, then that's going to be it ends up becoming a big problem, because what a lot of people started saying when RDFA went out there was, sure, Facebook supports RDFA, but you can't really call it RDFA because, people aren't putting the prefixes in there. An actual RDFA processor won't extract anything from that markup. So the problem, I guess, is more a political than anything, is that people can basically say, well, it's both technical and political. It's technical because it's technically your extractor is not going to extract data from those documents, and if they're a million or 10 million documents out there with data that would be JSON-LD, had they included something in the initial context, and they didn't. It seems like it would be a bad move to not have a mechanism that could correct that. I also agree with Nicholas and Marcus, and I don't think that this is going to be as big of a deal for JSON-LD as it was for RDFA. And I think, Greg, if there's a, if we don't include this initial context, there could still be there could be this loose agreement between the implementers that if we need an initial context, we will all implement it in the exact same way, and we will do it before, we'll basically all do it such that it becomes a requirement for all JSON-LD processors.
How does that work? I don't quite get
it's
that.
Just all of us on the call just say we're going to implement the initial context. We tell Yvonne to set up a document in W3C and publish it, and we implement basically hard coding that context in our implementations, or downloading the context whenever we need to initialize a JSON-LD processor.
Well, why not have it in the spec then? I don't understand.
If Nicholas and Marcus feel very, very strongly about it, and they definitely don't want it in the spec, then it doesn't end up going in the spec. I'm just outlining two approaches. I think we would be okay with either approach. I think my preference is still to include the initial context and a URL for an initial context in the spec. And if we never use it, then no big deal. But if we really, really, really need it, it's there, right? So if we, if we do the little grid of all possible outcomes, if we put this into the spec and we don't need it, the outcome isn't that bad. If we don't put this into the spec and we do need it, the outcome's pretty bad, right?
So the least risky. It's pretty bad because we can't correct, or it's going to be very difficult for us to correct.
I see that a bit different. We can at any point add it, but we could never ever drop it again if we put it in there now.
That's true. Yep, that's true.
So
but
the other way around, to be honest.
But why is it such a big deal that we can't drop it?
If we implement it as we resolved it last time, we would have to define an external IRI where it can be retrieved. And that would, for example, mean that every JSON-LD processor every now and then has to go and fetch that document.
The way the RDFA initial context is implemented is that there's text in the spec that says that implementers may cache or hard code the contents of the initial context in their processor.
Yeah, but how do you fix the problem then?
Yeah.
Well, the assumption is that these implementers are going to keep their implementations up to date with the test suite.
Yeah, but I think it's much more likely that implementers will update if there is a new version of the spec, even if the only modification is just that an initial context was added.
Yeah, I just don't think we can wait years to address a problem like that, because the web doesn't move in years.
Yeah, and I think Greg is absolutely right there. The overhead for starting a new group, chartering, adding the feature, getting it to rec, the fastest that it could be done is 6 to 9 months. But more than likely, if that group was chartered, they wouldn't charter a new group just to add one feature to the spec. They would wait for other spec requirements to come in before the group was chartered. So we are talking, you know, anywhere from 9 months to 2 to 3 years for getting the next version of the spec out there.
But I just don't see the real scenario which would pop up for this would be something like, Facebook's prefix. And in general, in compact JSON-LD, you don't use prefixes that much in the code. You use terms. And we would hopefully never have the request from a big company that we should add all their terms to the default context. But given that we don't know if this gives license to big companies to say that users don't have to publish correct JSON-LD because they can affect the default context by force, then that's a bad scenario. And in general, in these cases, I think that the publishers of JSON-LD are different than the publishers of some RDFA in web documents, quite radically different for most of the time. And the easiest way to fix poor data is to fix the source, not an identified number of consumers with arbitrarily updatable processors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the other point is that in JSON-LD it's easily possible to reference an external context. So you can do that without problems. You can't do that in RDFA.
True.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think they're again, good points on either side. But I think the worst scenario is... So, Nicholas, we should probably end the call soon, but Nicholas, to respond to your point that, you know, we couldn't expect... A large company can't expect us to add, their vocabulary or their prefix into the default context. I think that's exactly what Google and Facebook expect, because if their position is if we bring, 150 million pages or 150 million data points into something that's JSON compatible, and if people like Yahoo and Google and Microsoft and those guys can agree on something like schema.org, they are in a very strong position to drive every single one of those terms going into the initial context. Whether we want that to happen or not, I totally agree that it's an absolutely awful It's awful for them to push that, but you know, that's what they do. They feel that they're entitled to. Well, then all they're going to do is they're going to say, fine, we're not going to use JSON-LD. We're going to name this something else, and the initial context is this, and there you go.
But the only user have to reference that initial context, like schema.org/ld.json or whatever. I mean, it's easy for publishers to reference any kind of context, and if we add this because we expect that they might want to add all the terms in schema.org in the implicit default context. I don't see that as good design. I see that as, I mean, we haven't had that request explicitly. We should wait until we have that and take it up at that point.
Right. Well, I guess the point is that we can't, If we wait for that request to come in, it's going to be too late, just like it was for RDFA.
I wouldn't want my processor to have all the terms just floating around there. It would be, it would make it harder for people to use JSON-LD in restricted environments and stuff like that. I'd much rather say that you, to a JSON-LD processor, can add in sort of any context you want to as a default context, which any other context explicitly defined is added to in that case, so that consumers can control it by themselves.
All right, so we're out of time for today. I think that's an interesting proposal. That's a discussion we also had in the RDF working group or the RDFA working group, and we decided not to do that for a variety of reasons. But we should discuss it again in this group because the base arguments that we're working from are different in this group than they were in the RDFA working group. Anything else that we should discuss or be aware of over the next week? Before we end the call?
No, just a quick remark to Niklas' last comment. I mean, we already can do that in Expand, and everywhere we have an optional context parameter.
Mm-hmm.
So you can define your own.
But true. I was thinking if there were some kind of situation where you had a compact JSON which refers to a context in itself, and with this you might preload something else before that is applied. But that's details. We should look into that.
All right. Okay. We're going to have another 90-minute call next week. We made good progress today on these issues, so hopefully we'll be able to keep at this pace for the next couple of weeks, and we'll hopefully be through most of the issues at that point. All right, guys. Have a great week, and we'll chat again next Tuesday.
You too. All right. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.